This is The Guardian.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Rishi Sunak held an emergency press conference on Wednesday afternoon announcing a rollback of some of the government's net zero targets.
If we continue down this path, we risk losing the consent of the British people.
He may be hoping to claw back a few votes, but the move has brought a furious reaction from environmentalists and perhaps more surprisingly, criticism from some big businesses. Meanwhile, Keir Starmer has been in Paris this week meeting Emmanuel Macron.
We had a very constructive and positive meeting.
Could this be the beginning of a very long road back into Europe? I'm Gabby Hinsliff, in for John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. In a minute, we'll be joined by John Henley, The Guardian's Europe correspondent, to discuss developments on the Brexit and European fronts. But first, let's just try and unpick what's been a big moment, really, in British climate politics. It's Wednesday afternoon as we're speaking, and we've just heard an emergency press conference, hastily called by Rishi Sunak, where the Prime Minister has confirmed that the government intends to roll back on some of their key green targets. Here's some of what he said.
Net zero is going to be hard and will require us to change. But in a democracy, we must also be able to scrutinise and debate those changes, many of which are hidden in plain sight, in a realistic manner. This debate needs more clarity, not more emotion. The test should be, do we have the fairest credible path to reach net zero by 2050 in a way that brings people with us? Since I've become Prime Minister, I've examined our plans, and I don't think they meet that test. We seem to have defaulted to an approach which will impose unacceptable costs on hard-pressed British families, costs that no one was ever really told about.
Joining me now from the Commons is Alita Adu, The Guardian's political correspondent.
Hi, Gabby.
It's felt like a really dramatic day, but what has actually changed when the dust settles? Is it a big policy shift, or is it really more of a shift of tone and language around climate?
I must say, Gabby, we've seen Rishi Sunak starting to crumble. He is clearly extremely desperate to please a number of factions within the Conservative Party, and he is very unsuccessful in doing so far, I must say. So he confirmed that the UK would no longer plan to end the sale of new gas boilers by 2035. He said he'd push back the deadline for selling new petrol and diesel cars by 5 years to 2035, and that he'd no longer require homeowners and landlords to meet energy efficiency targets. All because he's promising to save British households struggling at the moment because of the cost of living crisis lots of money to stop their bills continuing to spiral ahead of what is going to be quite another difficult period of winters. But we must remember, Gabby, that this is a Prime Minister without a mandate. He took the keys to Number 10 for a government that was elected on a manifesto that promised to deliver the most ambitious environmental programme of any country on earth. So we've now got the Conservative Party looking pretty divided, definitely split in two, if not into more fractions.
As you say, very strong reaction from some parts of the Conservative Party, not just Chris Skidmore, you know, Zach Goldsmith, Alok Sharma, you know, lots of people with an interest in climate policies. Do we know why now? Because it's a slightly odd time to announce a big change of policy when Parliament's just going into recess, you know, MPs can't debate it. The Speaker said, you know, that he would recall Parliament if he had the powers, because he felt this was an important decision that, you know, needed to be discussed. And it's not very long since Michael Gove was saying, you know, oh, don't believe what you read in the papers. The government's absolutely committed to net zero. Do we think there's been some internal debate about this in cabinet? And do we know why, you know, suddenly coming to a head now and what feels like a bit of a scramble, really?
I think for a number of months now, I've heard of many Conservative MPs desperate for Rishi to sort of lay out a vision for where he sees the party going. I don't think the party intentionally would have preferred this sort of announcement to have come specifically on the first day of recess when they were trying to get their ideas together ahead of a Conservative Party conference, but more so because it was leaked by a number of disgruntled insiders who felt that this needed to be shared. This isn't looking very good for the party, I would say, from a broader perspective. But I think they may be able to jump on the fact that Labour is not really setting out their stalls and being able to promise exactly what they would do differently.
There's a broader challenge here for Labour, really, isn't there? Which is, you know, if the Tories are going to try and make climate a dividing line going into the election, if they're going to try and, you know, portray Labour as the party whose green policy would put your bills up or in hot to just up oil or whatever it is they want to say, there's a challenge to Labour, which is, do they, you know, hold fast to their line on net zero, or are they tempted to kind of trim it and fall in behind what government's saying? And do they also want, given that business has complained about the degree of chopping and changing and instability and unpredictability and not knowing what the targets are from one day to the next, you know, does Labour want to contribute to that by reversing a U-turn once it's in power?
Yes, I guess it's more of, you know, what they've been doing so far, holding your cards close to your chest, not saying too much that will allow the Conservatives to jump and start, you know, launching some campaigns already. But yes, I think for Labour, the strategy will be to wait as long as possible and as close as possible to when the general election is called, to start detailing exactly how they will be saving people money. I can assure you we'll be seeing plenty of conflict over this issue.
And possibly another year of it to go. Thank you very much, Lita. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And if you want more detailed analysis on Rishi Sunak's announcements, you can listen to our sister podcast, Today in Focus, where Nosheen Iqbal has been speaking to The Guardian's Kieran Stacey. This week, The Guardian launched its new European Digital Edition to showcase the best of our original journalism about Europe, along with the most relevant of our global news and views. So delighted to be joined from Paris by John Henley, The Guardian's Europe correspondent. Hello, John.
Hi, Gabby.
This week, you've published a study looking at the rise of populist and fringe parties in Europe, showing, I think, a third of European voters now vote for far left, far right or anti-establishment parties. We're going to get into the sort of origins and causes of that rise of populism a bit later. But what sort of issues are those parties feeding off? What's given them a foothold, would you say?
Well, it's a really complex question, and there's a whole range of issues. Obviously, I think if you wanted to kind of summarise them, it would be a kind of just a growing range of sort of insecurities among voters, and a feeling of a kind of a lack of control and a lack of order. And it's this, obviously, that the populist parties, particularly the populist far right parties, promise. Whether they can deliver it or not is, of course, another matter, but that's their promise. And so it's around things like, I mean, the original sort of golden triangle of populism and far-right populism was obviously immigration, anti-Islam, a good dose of Euroscepticism, and really strong sense of nationalism as national identity, sovereignty, that kind of thing. But that's really expanded lately over the last sort of decade or so, particularly, and you've added to that now economic insecurity, cost of living crises, that kind of thing, a growing mistrust of the mainstream political parties and of the state and of what the state is doing. And that's really been fueled by COVID and most recently of all, perhaps, the green transition and the cost of the green transition and who's actually going to have to bear it.
And talking of exactly that, across Europe, I mean, every government is surely grappling with this idea that saving the planet might involve sacrifices, it might cost householders money, it might mean personal inconvenience. Is anyone else backtracking, or are we the odd one out on climate?
Well, there's certainly the beginnings of a green lash, if you like, a kind of backlash against the green transition and the green agenda. It's stronger in some countries than others. We've seen it really reach a peak, certainly sort of earlier this year, late last year, in countries like the Netherlands, of course, like the really huge agricultural producer, world's second biggest agricultural producer. And there's a whole new political party there, the Farmer Citizens Movement, which actually won provincial elections in February on a platform of kind of fighting the government's plans to close down farms and buy farmers up to cut nitrogen emissions. I mean, in Germany, there's a similar kind of movement underway, really. The German car industry, obviously hugely powerful, has just kind of secured exemptions for it from the EU's plan to kind of all new cars sold in Europe are electric by 2035. They've secured exemptions for kind of synthetic fuels so that, you know, traditional combustion engines can be used for a bit longer. There's similarly a huge row in Germany at the moment over the replacement of gas boilers. So it's definitely really underway. It's something that, you know, I think every European government is going to have to deal with.
And yet there is a sort of pushback in the other direction to some extent, isn't there? We've seen, I mean, here in the UK, we've seen the car company Ford, the energy company E.ON, all coming out and criticising the government U-turn, saying, you know, well, as businesses, we wanted predictability. We want you to set a target and stick to it. We don't want you to change your mind in the middle of a business cycle. You know, I mean, there are sort of downsides to governments are chopping and changing, and particularly potentially risks to investment, aren't there? Why would you invest in the UK? Why don't you put your car factory in Poland or somewhere else if you know, you can at least have a predictable policy field somewhere else?
But I mean, it's just a very, very delicate line for governments to tread, really. It's a real kind of tightrope act, because what we're talking about here is the personal and individual costs of the green transition getting real, you know, and actually beginning to have a kind of a concrete impact on people's lives. Companies are ahead of that game and have got one agenda. A lot of people are anxious about it. And as soon as you start to create that sort of anxiety and this sort of feel of, well, actually, what, how is this going to affect me? And am I really going to have to get rid of my car? And how can I possibly afford to buy a new one? And what's the kind of low transmission zones going to mean for me? And all these issues, that becomes really fertile ground for the populists.
Absolutely, especially in a cost of living crisis. Although I kind of, you know, to be careful talking about this, not to forget, there's a whole moral side of the argument too. I mean, the idea, it can sound in all this kind of talk about, you know, costs and practicalities and sort of political machinations, the sort of idea of saving the planet or sort of the existential urgency that's facing all of us kind of gets lost. I mean, if you're sitting in, I don't know, on the island of Rhodes and you lost your house to a forest fire this summer, this must all sound fairly academic.
It's how you put into concrete practice policies that are going to be absolutely essential and are already absolutely essential for the survival of the planet, but are absolutely undeniably going to negatively impact people's day-to-day lives, or at least the kind of the lifestyles and the standard of living that they've grown accustomed to. That's the nub of the problem, I think, and for all political parties. And there are some that are going to be responsible about it, and some that are just going to see it as an opportunity to rally support and galvanise support for their agenda.
Just to backtrack for a minute here, I mean, you've said, and, you know, I think we're all seeing the way in which sort of resentment about net zero and the cost of net zero provides fertile ground for populists to exploit. But obviously the rise of populism predates all that. This kind of distrust, this underpinning disillusionment with mainstream politics that sort of, you know, is the wellspring from which it comes. Where do you think that originally comes from? Because in a way, it seems sort of almost unsurprisingly, conventional politics has arguably failed to solve some really big issues over the last 10 to 15 years. You can kind of see why, where that disillusionment sets in.
I mean, I think if you talk to political scientists, their view is that there's basically been a kind of a breakdown of multiple consensuses among electorates all over the continent, really. And there's been a breakdown of the kind of cultural consensus, a broad cultural consensus that arguably started with 9/11. There's been a breakdown of the sort of economic consensus, which began arguably with the great financial and economic crisis that started in Europe in 2008. And then more recently, there's been a real breakdown of the kind of European and what is Europe and what are we here for and how do we make it work consensus, which began with the great migration crisis of 2015, when well over a million migrants arrived in Europe, and you know, continued with Brexit. So there's a lot of these kind of big, you know, societal consent breakdowns that have kind of been happening. And I think it's, you're absolutely right, it's completely fair to say that the mainstream centre-right and centre-left parties, these big kind of umbrella catch-all parties, that kind of try to represent everybody, and have essentially run most European countries in alternation since the end of the Second World War, they really haven't adjusted, and they haven't adapted, and they haven't responded. And so there's just a growing perception among voters that, as one of the political scientists that I spoke to puts it, that these big mainstream parties have basically become office-seeking organisations and only office-seeking organisations. They don't really look beyond that.
In the UK, obviously, we haven't had, you know, fringe parties getting seats in Parliament as you have in lots of other European countries, presumably primarily because of first past the post. It's difficult for new parties to break through here. You kind of think that in 2015, if we'd had PR here, we'd probably have got Nigel Farage as an MP. But instead, of course, we to an extent got the Farageification of the Conservative Party. You know, it moves to the right to kind of almost absorb that populist instinct. I think in the study you're reporting on, they genuinely considered sort of classifying the Tories as a sort of fringe populist party. Is that right? Rather than the mainstream one?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And they considered it with several mainstream European parties, actually. And what they've really seen is that, you know, if the kind of, you know, the gap between the far right and the centre right has shrunk in recent years, it's much less because the far right has become less radical and much more because the centre right has become more radical. And so if you look, I mean, certainly from a continental perspective, if you look at a party like the Tories and the current government, current Tory government in Britain, I mean, on several policy areas, it's a radical right party, you know, and it's also a populist radical right party. As soon as you start talking about railing against lefty lawyers, as soon as you start coming up with plans to ship kind of, you know, hundreds or thousands of asylum seekers and migrants to Rwanda to be processed, I mean, you're firmly in the kind of territory that in the EU would make someone like Marine Le Pen blush, as the centre-right has kind of adopted far-right discourse. The far-right has become normalised in political life, in society, but certainly on the media. And what's really increased is not necessarily the kind of core vote of the populist far-right, but the tolerance, the kind of popular tolerance for the populist far-right.
OK, let's pause here for a minute. And when we come back, we'll be looking at the future for Britain in Europe and whether Labour might be intending to play their cards very differently to the Conservatives if they win office.
Hello, I'm Grace Dent. I'm back and I've been busy. My new book, Comfort Eating, which is based on our award-winning podcast, is out now. You can get hold of it at guardianbookshop.com. And from Tuesday, the podcast is returning for its next season with an exciting lineup, including Shirley Ballas, Bridget Christie, Jamie Demetrio, and many more. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to join me on book tour, I'll be in London on the 9th of October and in Manchester on the 11th, talking about my go-to comfort foods and a lot more. Get your tickets today from membership.theguardian.com/events. I can't wait to see you there.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss.
That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A third of students are less than happy about their university choice, new research by EY has revealed. The findings suggest that a digital rethink is essential to meet the expectations of students and staff. Universities can address this by putting the needs of the people they serve at the heart of their digital strategies. Learn more about the future of human-centered higher education at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Welcome back. So Keir Starmer has been in Paris this week to meet Emmanuel Macron in a trip clearly designed to present him as a kind of PM in waiting, someone world leaders are queuing up to meet. It's a big change from Liz Truss, obviously saying she couldn't say whether Macron was our friend or our foe. But John, what do they make of him in Paris? I mean, does if you stopped a sort of stranger on the street tomorrow, would they have a clue who Keir Starmer was?
Probably not, but that's probably not that unusual. I'm not sure how many of your French men and women in the street would recognise very many foreign politicians. They certainly recognise Boris Johnson, which
Great.
Is why...
Great, that's our image abroad, thank you.
which is why Starmer's visit is welcome at least on one level, which is as a sign of the continuing improvement in Franco-British relations, which really hit rock bottom during the Johnson and Truss years. You know, I mean, Johnson was just considered as a sort of populist, dishonest, self-seeking joker in Paris who you couldn't take seriously and you couldn't trust. Macron is always keen to meet. Starmer is very far from the first European opposition politician that he's met. He's always keen to kind of keep his ears on the ground and stay in touch with, you know, what might be coming up. And obviously, Starmer is looking for, to raise as much influence as he possibly can in Europe. And France is inevitably the best place to start with that for a British politician.
Back in the days when I used to have to go to EU summits a lot as a reporter, I'd always kind of try and go to the French media briefing and the British media briefing after it, because you'd always get a totally, you know, the British would be all about how we trumped the treacherous French in X deal, and the French side would be all about how we screwed the British. Here the briefing has been that the sort of talks were warm and engaged, but that they didn't go into any detail really on Brexit or immigration or anything like that. Is that also the readout on your side?
Yes, pretty much. I mean, there was nothing detailed here, and I don't think anybody expected it. It was a bit of a sort of a meet and greet and a handshake opportunity and a kind of get to know each other. Obviously, we don't know, we're not privy to what the conversation was between Macron and Starmer, but just sort of speaking generally, you know, I mean, Macron can't do anything on immigration without the EU. It's an EU sort of policy decision. And the EU generally has more than enough on its plate, only in terms of immigration. I mean, if you look this past weekend, Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, and Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission President, were in Lampedusa, which is a very small Italian island, a couple of hundred kilometres from Tunisia, which has 5,000 inhabitants. And over the course of 3 days, late last week, saw the arrival of 7,000 migrants. So more than the population of the island. Immigration is a massive issue in Europe. The EU is deeply divided over. You have the kind of frontier countries, Spain and Greece and Italy, who have to deal with the brunt of the arrivals. You have wealthier northern countries, which is where most of those arrivals want to get to, but they don't particularly want them to come. You have Eastern European countries, Central European countries, Hungary and Poland, who are absolutely, you know, flat out opposed to accepting any new relocations. I mean, it's a huge issue in Europe. And if anybody in Britain, frankly, I'm sorry to sound a bit kind of, you know, outspoken about this, but if anybody in Britain, frankly, thinks that given that situation and given all the other issues that it has to cope with, the issue of keep maintaining unity over the war in Ukraine, eventual expansion to the east to include Ukraine, I mean, there's so much on the EU's plate. That if anybody thinks that they're going to accord kind of any sort of special treatment to a country that only a couple of years ago voted to leave the EU, I mean, it's not so much that they don't really want to, it's just that there's not the bandwidth to do it. There isn't the interest, there isn't the scope. And I think generally speaking, if Starmer is elected and does become British Prime Minister, I mean, I think the bottom line for me actually is that the overwhelming impression from the continent is that actually neither party is yet being honest with British voters about what Brexit actually means, about what kind of relationship with Europe is going to be possible in the future, about what kind of asks are realistic and might be entertained, about what Britain is it actually economically going to need to do. And nobody is really yet spelling that out for very understandable kind of political reasons.
I mean, I was going to say there must be some awareness, you know, realistically in Brussels that there's an election coming up in a year's time, that you might not get a great deal of sense out of British politicians about Brexit until the other side of that election, that, you know, really these are the sort of very early stages of the game.
Of course that's right, and of course there is that understanding, and of course Brussels and the EU capitals understand that you know both sets of politicians in the UK are talking to their home audience. But you know, given the record of the past sort of 5, 6, 7 years, there's very much a kind of wait and see. And I think beyond that, I think there's the sort of overriding sentiment in Brussels and in the capitals is that they don't have the time or the space or the inclination to kind of tinker around the edges. You know, there might be small, discrete, individual gains and win-wins for sort of both sides that might be achieved.
Like the Horizon programme recently.
Yeah, there's certainly no inclination to open up, you know, the trade and cooperation agreement, to really kind of dig into the guts of you know, veterinary inspections and trade, you know, that kind of stuff. Honestly, I think it will take some kind of really big gesture on the part of the UK that recognises, this is the crucial thing, I think, that recognises that whatever the UK demands in future, there has to be something in it for Europe.
That's the one thing that domestically Keir Starmer cannot stay, because you have the government saying, he wants to unpick the Brexit deal, he's going to take Brexit away from
him. And I think anything short of Britain re-entering the single market and the customs union, at the moment in Brussels, is considered probably to be not worth the candle.
It's almost like you're saying, John, that the world does not revolve around the UK. I mean, you know, I just throw that out there as a thought. Could it be that that we are not, in fact, the be-all and end-all?
You might possibly say that. I think that is one of the things that you see when you're based on the continent. The absolutely, I don't think it's unique to Britain, but it's very, very powerful in Britain. The British prism, the Anglo-British prism through which Britain views the world is exceptionally powerful and sometimes very distorting.
Well, it's goodbye from this small, rainy, insignificant island. And thank you very much, John, for joining us.
Pleasure.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. And even better, leave us a review, maybe even a nice one. And before you go, can I just tell you about Grace Dent, who will be returning with The Guardian's podcast Comfort Eating on the 26th of September. She'll be taking celebrity guests down memory lanes, talking about their most memorable food moments. And guests this series include John Ronson, Nadia Hussein and Shirley Ballas. Back from Tuesday, 26th of September. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage.
Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.